WFMU, and who was gazing at their shoes in 1987? Certainly a lot of British fans of the band Loop, and that is from a reissued Heaven's End. Probably the stoogiest of the shoegazers. And that is Head On, which features a whole disc of extras and BBC sessions and such. Well worth checking out if you're a fan of Spaceman 3 and such. We heard The Crazy Birds from another track from that great International Vicious Society Volume 4 record of just weird trash from the 60s from around the world. And that band came from Mexico, The Crazy Birds, and Guarache's Con Tecon from a killer garage compilation of all 1960s African sounds, which we played for you last week as well. We heard something else from it, Les Crackmen from the Crackmen Twist. Brand new behind that from Audacity, who I think are from California, from a new LP called Power Drowning. Full-length LP on the Burger record label, which definitely is from California. Audacity did Mode. We heard Devo and the demo of The Day My Baby Gave Me a Surprise, found on a Rhino disc, part of the Rhino Handmade series. I don't even know if they're making them anymore. Collectible compact discs? Does it exist? I'm not even sure in this day and age, but that is from a 2-CD set called Recombo DNA. Devo, who always had great demos. If you ever find that Ryko disc thing that came out of all the basement stuff from the early, early 70s, back when they were still a bunch of long hairs, that stuff is great. I think it's called Hardcore Devo. We heard Ratas del Vaticano, speaking of Mexican rock and roll. That is from the new LP on Silt Breeze, just out this week, called Mocosos Patéticos. And that band features one ex-member of Los Llamarada, Violeta. That is a great new record. We heard Paranoia. We heard Hatred Surge and Servant from the Dear Healer record label 7-inch. And Ferdiduke, starting us all off, from a split single with Bonal. And Main Song is what we heard all here on WFMU. And time to get on out of here, make way for Dave Emery coming up in just moments. But thanks for tuning in today, and thanks again to the Puffy Areolas for a killer blaster disaster of a blowout session in the WFMU studio and lavatory. And don't forget, you can see him tonight at Monster Island over at 128 River Street in Brooklyn. That's on the corner of Metropolitan. And Kevin from Pink Reason is going to be DJing, I just found out. So should be a fun time. Bunch of good bands tonight. And thanks to you for tuning in. We're going to be back next Tuesday at the 3 o'clock p.m. hour. Are we going to be George Bushless then? I'm not sure. I think so. Joe Bielak was kissing him off today, but I'm going to refrain from kicking the man to the curb because, you know, just a couple more days. Bite your tongues. But stay tuned. Dave Emery's coming up next. I'm sure he'll have something to say about it. And we'll be back next Tuesday at 3 o'clock. You can email us, by the way, bt@wfmu.org. And our playlists are online at wfmu.org/playlist/bt. There's MySpace links and such as well. Stay with us, everybody, and have a great week. We'll talk to you later. This is WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Sod 1 of For the Record program number 659, titled Heating It Up for Obama. This is being recorded on January 4th of the year 2009. Before we get into the main body of the broadcast, this will also exemplify why listeners should be using SpitfireList.com. It's the best source for information about anti-fascist, period. Also, I'm very happy to announce, as of January 4th, 2009, all of the archive shows and lectures are available on very usable MP3 files. So the old RFA series, now retitled AFA, Anti-Fascist Archives, are now available for download for free. And I would recommend, for example, as background to this program, the massive shows AFA 36, The Destabilization of the Soviet Union, and AFA 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. It's a massive archive, but it is there. And this broadcast also will exemplify why listeners should use the website. A number of terms that you'll need to do some research on the website to fully comprehend in the context of this broadcast. One is the virtual state. We're going to be talking about the Underground Reich, and it is what literally a Third Reich that went underground and perpetuated itself in mafia-like style. Also, an underground axis, because the fascist Japanese did the same thing. It was not an aberration. It was part of an international cartel system. There's good discussion of that on the website, and there are books you can read about it. But the virtual state was what Philip Bobbitt, a national security expert and professor at the University of Texas, used it in application to Al-Qaeda. It applies to the Underground Reich. It is a state, but it does not have formal geographical boundaries. The Underground Reich, rather, is present in many seemingly disparate elements, and we're going to talk about those disparate elements in this program. It's present in elements of the Muslim and Arab communities. It's present big time here in the United States. It's present in Europe. It is present to a smaller but a vibrant extent in Israel. It is present all over another term. It's a present all over the world, but another term people are going to want to understand is the Earth Island. It's that stretch of land going from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, most of the Middle East, former Soviet Union, China, India, and Pakistan. And it has most of the world's population, most of the world's mineral resources, most of the world's oil, and right across the middle of it is a vast stretch of Muslim population. We're going to be examining aspects of the Underground Reich, and it is my considered professional opinion that the outgoing Bush administration, like Bush 1 and also the Reagan administrations, are literally extensions of the Underground Reich. And we're going to start in the Middle East, and we're going to examine the virtual state, we're going to examine economics, and we're going to travel across the Earth Island. We're going to take a look at activities not only in the Middle East but in Georgia, some very interesting things happening there. We're going to take a look at what's going on between India and Pakistan. We're also going to take a look at some of the economic relationships between Muslim Brotherhood functionaries, such as Prince Al-Walid of Saudi Arabia, and powerful economic, political, and media forces here in the United States. We're also going to take a look at some suspicious deaths, too. So that's what's on tap. SpitfireList.com is the resource to use to flesh out your understanding. And I'm very happy to announce that with the new year, all of the archive shows, not only the massive AFA archive shows, the anti-fascist archives, formerly RFA, and also the miscellaneous archive shows, the Guns of November, and the lectures are all available for download for free. And also on the Spitfire website, very compact, usable MP3 files are available for all of the For the Record shows through 600. And those of you who have trouble with real audio, and some people have expressed difficulties, you can now download the vast majority of the For the Record series from the Spitfire website on MP3. That having been said, we're going to take a quick look at what's been going on in the Middle East. We're going to take a look at it in a somewhat different context. Very interesting reference was made in the San Jose Mercury News of December 30th of 2008. It's an article titled, "Palestinians and Israelis Bitter Over civilian toll. It's by Richard Boudreau and Ahmed Bourai of the Los Angeles Times. But skipping down, we're going to take this is going to be our departure for an examination of the virtual state and the Earth Island. Skipping down, Hamas, whose charter calls for the Jewish state's destruction, is urging a campaign of suicide bombings in Israel. It goes on to talk about the war itself. But the Hamas charter, something we talked about in For the Record 601, is an interesting thing to review as a point of departure for our discussion. Also bear in mind that Hamas is the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. Also understand that one of the more powerful figures in the global economy, Prince Al-Walid of Saudi Arabia, is Muslim Brotherhood and does fundraising telethons in Saudi Arabia for Hamas. And we're going to be talking about Prince Al-Walid in a number of different contexts, media ownership, bank ownership, and various things. But remember that Al-Walid, one of the dominant players on the multinational corporate scene, is Muslim Brotherhood and does fundraising for Hamas in Saudi Arabia. What we're going to do is review from For the Record 601, the Hamas Charter, because it is indicative, I think, of the difference between popular opinion and the realities of the Underground Reich, a virtual state present in the Muslim and Islamic community in the form of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Hamas Charter reads, "For our struggle against the Jews is extremely wide-ranging and grave, so much so that it will need all the loyal efforts we can wield to be followed by further steps and reinforced by successive battalions from the multifarious Arab and Islamic world until the enemies are defeated and Allah's victory prevails. The Prophet, prayer and peace be upon him, said, 'The time will not come until Muslims will fight the Jews and kill them, until the Jews hide behind rocks and trees, which will cry, "O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me. Come on and kill him," unquote. The enemies have been scheming for a long time, and they have consolidated their schemes in order to achieve what they have achieved. They took advantage of key elements in unfolding events and accumulated a huge and influential material wealth which they put to the service of implementing their dream. This wealth permitted them to take over control of the world media such as news agencies, the press, publication houses, broadcasting, and the like. They also used this wealth to stir revolutions in various parts of the globe in order to fulfill their interests and pick the fruits. They stood behind the French and the communist revolutions and behind most of the revolutions we hear about here and there," unquote. They, parenthetically the Jews, also used the money to establish such clandestine organizations which are spreading around the world in order to destroy societies and carry out Zionist interests. Such organizations are the Freemasons, Rotary Clubs, the Lions Clubs, B'nai B'rith, and the like. All of them are destructive spying organizations. They also used the money to take over control of the imperial estates and made them colonize many countries in order to exploit the wealth of those countries and spread their corruption therein. As regards local and world wars, it has come to pass, and no one objects, that they stood behind World War I so as to wipe out the Islamic Caliphate. They collected material gains and took control of many sources of wealth. They obtained the Balfour Declaration and established the League of Nations in order to rule the world by means of that organization. They also stood behind World War II, where they collected immense benefits from trading with war materials and prepared for the establishment of their state. They inspired the establishment of the United Nations and the Security Council to replace the League of Nations in order to rule the world by their intermediary. There was no way that war broke out anywhere. There is no way that war broke out anywhere without their fingerprints on it. Their scheme has been laid out in the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and their present conduct is the best proof of what is said there. Within the circle of the conflict with world Zionism, the Hamas regards itself as the spearhead and the avant-garde. It joins its efforts to all those who were active on the Palestinian scene, but more steps need to be taken by the Arab and Islamic peoples and Islamic associations throughout the Arab and Islamic world in order to make possible the next round with the Jews, the merchants of war, unquote. I'm reviewing this because what you're seeing here has, in and of itself, nothing to do with anything that could be properly viewed as Islamic per se, or anything really to do with Arab culture. What this is pure unadulterated, straight down the line Nazi ideology. Perhaps some of you didn't know that the Freemasons and the Rotary Clubs and the Lions Clubs were part of the International Zionist Conspiracy. Well, of course, it's drivel. Note the quoting of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. One of the points that I've tried to make over the years is that the Muslim Brotherhood is an Islamic fascist organization. These are Arab Muslim Nazis, plain and simple, and it is one element of the virtual state that Philip Bobbitt talked about. We're going to end up, by the way, talking some more about what's going on in the Middle East. One of the things that I want to call to people's attention, though, is the use of the media and the Nazi slash Arab slash fascist control of American media and media in a lot of the rest of the world, basically doing what Serpent's Walk talks about. That's the Nazi tract put out by the National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the American Neo-Nazi National Alliance. It talks about the Third Reich going underground and basically gaining control of the opinion-forming media. Largest media corporation in the world is AOL, Time Warner, which is controlled by a minority consortium of Saudi princes led by Prince Al-Waleed. We're going to talk about Fox News later. Fox News, of course, is the media voice. It's the second largest media corporation in the world, and the second largest stockholder behind Gruppenführer Murdoch himself is the self-same Prince Al-Waleed, who recently increased his stock and changed it to voting stock. He is the second largest stockholder in News Corp, the second largest media corporation in the world. By the way, Prince Al-Waleed also had tremendous sway he's the largest stockholder in Citicorp and has huge sway here in the United States. Third largest media corporation is ABC, Disney. ABC was bought out by Capital Cities, which in the mid-80s, that was founded by William Casey, who not only handled the State Department machinations to bring the Crusade for Freedom Nazis into the United States, where they blossomed into the Nazi branch of the Republican Party. He also, William Casey of the Crusade for Freedom, also had Heinrich Rupp, a former Luftwaffe ME-262 pilot, as his personal pilot. That is the ABC branch of ABC Disney. Walt Disney himself, as discussed in For the Record at 301, Mickey Mauschwitz, was a regular attendee at American Nazi parties prior to the outbreak of World War II. And the Disney Resorts Division is heavily invested in by Prince Al-Waleed. In fact, Prince Al-Waleed, Muslim Brotherhood fundraiser for Hamas, is arguably the banner carrier, to coin a term, for the Disney Resorts Division and Disney Recreation Parks Division in Asia. It would be impossible to exaggerate the capital participation of Prince Al-Waleed in the resorts division of Disney, which is part of ABC Disney overall. Fourth largest media corporation is Bertelsmann. That was the publishing house for the SS. Its old man, Heinrich Mohn, was SS, and its house historian, Dirk Bavendam, as recently as 1998, published a book blaming the outbreak of World War II on, surprise, surprise, Jewish control of the media, U.S. imperialism, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Not too far, by the way, from the tack being taken by syndicated columnist Pat Buchanan in this country. When Pat Buchanan left as Ronald Reagan's White House media director in the mid-80s, he was replaced by a guy named Kohler, who was forced to resign when it came out that he had been in the Hitler Youth. So note the media coverage of what has taken place. We're going to go into some of the media coverage at greater length next week. My own feeling is that it's a situation that was that basically the Israelis would be damned if they did and damned if they didn't. Figures the ground campaign is going to be bloody, and ultimately I do not think that it's going to be politically successful, militarily perhaps, but politically I think Israel was doomed from the get-go. In fact, that was the idea. We're going to talk about that when we assess the legacy of Otto von Bolschfing next week. But note that when one sort of sifts through the hysteria, prior to the ground assault, approximately 100, give or take, Palestinian civilians had been killed. By the estimates of people on the ground, the areas that were hit were leafleted in advance, and those were in all probability largely the family members, etc., for Hamas combatants. Also bear in mind that it is a war crime to station fighters and weapons in civilian areas and use them as shields. Not only does Hamas do that as a matter of methodology, but the Hezbollah did that in the Lebanon war as well. Also note the faking of atrocities as well. This against the context or in the context and against the background of the book Serpent's Walk. It's why I talk about Serpent's Walk so often. We're going to come back to all of this, and we're going to begin swinging across the Earth Island. We're going to move now from the Middle East eventually to we're going to move to what has been taking place in Pakistan and India. We're going to take a look at what is going on in Georgia. We're also going to be examining some suspicious deaths, too. And before we leave the subject of the Israeli-Arab conflict, San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, December 3rd of 2008, before the most recent outbreak of hostilities, has an article by Kevin Fagan of the Chronicle. It's called Israel Activists' Mysterious Fall in Elevator Shaft. Death of doctor looks like an accident, San Francisco police say. Well, that may be what the police say. I got my doubts. It reads in part, it was a bizarre and abrupt way to die for a man who, by all accounts, went at life full bore and was fit and agile from riding his bicycle everywhere he went. But as San Francisco police combed over the evidence Tuesday, investigators said this is what appears to have happened. Dr. Daniel J. Kleiman, an Alameda physician and one of the Bay Area's foremost pro-Israel activists, stepped into an open elevator shaft by accident last week and died. His body was found Monday by workers inspecting an elevator in the historic nine-story Sharon building at 55 New Montgomery Street, where Kleiman apparently plunged to his death November 25th. As news of the discovery filtered out Tuesday, his supporters and friends were in near disbelief that someone so dynamic could be gone. By the way, this guy was also an open, out-of-the-closet gay person as well. And turning into this, and again, I'm skeptical about the accidental death ruling here. He, meaning Kleiman, had been taking Arabic language courses in the Sharon building for 3 years, and it was last seen, investigators said, on the night of November 25th when he went there to attend a class on the seventh floor. Actually, it eventually came out that he went there after hours, and they, in order to have done what he supposedly did, he would have to have pried open the elevator doors and then stepped into an empty elevator shaft. The Krimsky here is Police Inspector Matt Krimsky. Some in Kleiman's activist community wondered Tuesday if he had been killed by someone he loudly opposed in street demonstrations over the years, but Krimsky called that possibility beyond remote, unquote. There is no indication of any foul play at this point, even though I've been getting calls from conspiracy theorists from everywhere, even someone who said they had information from a seance, unquote. Skipping down, this the Meltzer here is Faith Meltzer. Faith Meltzer, a member of SF Voice for Israel, said she will push police to investigate the matter until all chance of homicide is eliminated. It's hard for me to believe this wasn't deliberate, Meltzer said. Well, again, what ultimately the death was ruled accidental. Supposedly he went there after hours, pried open an elevator door shaft, which according to the superintendent of the building would have to have been locked, and then stepped into an empty elevator shaft and plunged seven floors to his death. Again, I'm kind of skeptical about that, and it reminds me of the Mr. DeVee O'Shea, who ran a hedge fund that was bankrupted in the Madoff affair. He supposedly took his own life and slashed his wrists with a box cutter and took sleeping pills, managed to slice himself in the bicep. That's quite a miss if you're aiming for your wrists. But anyway, then again, I'm one of those conspiracy theorists. But do note that. We're going to talk about a death that even more suspicious later on in the program. This, however, of a Bush White House information technology person who appears to have been part of the covering up of the tracks of the Bush administration. What we're going to do now is to take a look. We're going to revisit the Mumbai incident. And I want a couple of points I want to make. In For the Record 657, not on the regular broadcast, but in the description, there is information that originally the Mumbai assault was scheduled for September 27th. It then, for whatever reason, was put off until right around the Thanksgiving holiday. I would also note that whether or not there's any connection between the scheduled date of the Mumbai assault and what happened about a week later on October 4th, the brother of the founder of Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate in Pakistan, was deported from the United States. And then the attack on Mumbai, originally scheduled for September 27th, was in fact realized right around the Thanksgiving holiday in the United States, when there was also reports of a threat against the subway system of the New York City, America's financial center, as Mumbai is India's financial center. I would also point out, too, that that threat, an al-Qaeda-slash-terrorist originated threat, according to the authorities, would certainly have had more resonance with people psychologically when the Mumbai assault unfolded in India at roughly the same time. Among the factors that has spurred the Israeli escalation of hostilities against Hamas was, oddly enough, something that came out of the Mumbai assault. People familiar with the facts of the Mumbai assault are aware that a rabbi and his wife, who ran a small yeshiva, a small synagogue in Mumbai, were taken prisoner and tortured and then executed. They were executed in front of their toddler son, who was found crying beside his parents' bodies with his corduroy pants drenched in blood. This played all over Israel, and that, in combination with the botching of the 06 war and with Hamas firing rockets with no discernible response, has played into the hands of the Likud party in Israel. Israel is approaching elections. Likud is the repository for the fascist element in the Zionist movement as well, and Likud has been gaining serious electoral strength behind the perceived military weakness of its potential opponents in the election. But in terms of psychological warfare, the Mumbai incident had a galvanizing effect on the sentiments of Israeli citizenry. San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, December 2nd of 2008, had an article by Mark Levy, L-A-V-I-E, of the Associated Press. It's an article that is headlined, India Blames Pakistanis and Calls for Punishment. More about that in a second, because this has had a significant effect on the war in Afghanistan. But the subheader is 2-year-old orphan heads for Israel. One of the psychosocial factors, really one of the psychological warfare factors that has driven the Israeli assault, was the fact that what I'm about to read was basically top shelf, so to speak, television news in Israel. This article reads, in part, the cries of little Moshe Holtzberg wounded hearts Monday at a tearful memorial for his parents in India. Mommy, 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 he wailed, clutching a toy basketball while squirming in the arms of mourners at the Mumbai synagogue. Then the toddler and the caretaker who rescued him during the terrorist attacks boarded a jet, along with the bodies of his parents and 4 other Jews slain at the Chabad house, to fly to Israel, a place the curly-haired 2-year-old had never seen. The wrenching scene at the service played over and over again on Israeli television as government officials, Chabad leaders, and relatives prepared for the funerals of the victims and the future of the orphaned Moshe. Skipping down. Moshe was spirited out of Chabad house on Thursday by Sandra Samuel, a nanny who had worked at the center for years. She found him crying beside his parents' bodies, his pants drenched in their blood. Well, again, this one played all over Israel, and it inflamed sentiments. What is really interesting here is that this had a very similar effect on Israeli popular sentiment as the Al-Dura incident had on Arab and Muslim sentiment around the world, with one very significant difference, and one that has not been pointed out. It's going to get pointed out here. The Al-Dura incident, people may recall, was an incident in the Second Intifada, when a small boy and his father, supposedly caught in a crossfire between Palestinian militants and the Israeli Defense Forces, was shot and killed by IDF forces. The problem with that is that it was a staged incident, and this has been ruled by a French appellate court. A number of analysts pointed out that the directions from which the shots that supposedly killed Mohammed al-Dura, basically it was inconsistent with where IDF forces were. Ultimately, some of the outtakes from that were captured. An Israeli activist named Philip Carcenti charged that the French television station that broadcast the al-Dura incident was guilty of knowingly publishing a falsified incident. He was then sued by the French journalist who presided over that, sort of the Walter Cronkite of France. After that, and that lawsuit was initially successful, it was appealed, and a French appellate court overturned the verdict. The al-Dura incident had a huge effect. It was cited by Osama bin Laden in connection with September 11th. The Pakistani militants who killed Daniel Pearl cited the al-Dura incident in their justification. Odd, isn't it, that the Jewish-controlled news media haven't given that French appellate court verdict a lot of play? Obviously, I'm being sarcastic. You're going to have to do some looking to find that out. Sometime this year, I hope to have Philip Carcenti as a guest. But do note that and view that against the background of Serpent's Walk. Not only the faking of the al-Dura incident, another faking of alleged Israeli atrocities. And this is not to say that I hold a brief for the fascist element in the Zionist movement or for the Likud party, who were the beneficiaries of things like this. But do note the effect of psychological warfare in the precipitation of world events. I would also note, too, that one of the many aspects of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamist fascist terrorists who have manifested themselves in various parts of the world, they are very sophisticated and they are very knowledgeable about psychological warfare and geopolitics. I think even a lot of their apologists in this country view them with sort of a patronizing and, in effect, perhaps unconscious neo-colonial way. They're basically seen as a bunch of darkies, unquote. They're not seen as real equals. They're seen as sort of the noble savage, or perhaps the noble savage, but kind of ticked off by Western imperialism, blah-de-blah-de-blah. They don't really give them credit for being shrewd practitioners of psychological warfare and geopolitics, and they are. In addition to the effect on Israeli popular sentiment of the Mumbai massacre also had a huge effect on what is taking place vis-a-vis India and Pakistan. We're going to go into that inside, too. An article from NDTV, the Press Trust of India, Saturday of January 3rd, India compiling evidence to share with PAC, Pakistan, and rest of world. As Islamabad continues to be in denial mode, India is compiling evidence about the role of Pakistan-based elements in the terror strikes for sharing it with the world besides their neighbor very soon. Please do note this. We're going to take a look inside, too, of what is taking place vis-a-vis the India-Pakistani conflict with regard to Mumbai. And all of this is taking place as Barack Obama is getting ready to become president of the United States. And we're going to be swinging from the Earth Island. We're going to take a look at what's going on in Georgia. And we're going to swing back to the United States, and we're going to see what people like Karl Rove and Governor Blagojevich of Illinois and Fox News are doing for Obama here in the United States. Obama is definitely having it heated up for him, folks, and he had his work cut out for him before the election. Now he has really got his work cut out for him. We're going to take a look at who's doing the cutting and just how far out that is inside, too. Please use the SpitfireList.com website. It is essential for understanding terms like Earth Island and the virtual state. It'll give you the background to things like the Muslim Brotherhood and many of the things that I talk about. Serpent's Walk, I can appreciate that many of the things I talk about will sound weird, incredible, what have you. Please use SpitfireList.com. It is the best source for this kind of information. As I said at the beginning of side one, please use the website because there's so much there, including now the entire, all of the archive shows. Using that website will be essential for understanding programs like this. We're going to plunge right in and we're going to take a look at the virtual state and the Earth Island. And we're going to take a look, we're going to resume where we left off in Side 1 with some of the fallout from the Mumbai massacre. Now, one of the things that I spoke about in For the Record 657, targeting the centers of finance, was that one expected element of fallout from the Mumbai massacre, obviously with Lashkar-e-Taiba, a Pakistani Muslim Brotherhood affiliate, having perpetrated the assault, that did not exactly set people in India to doing the varsity rag. On the contrary, they are putting together, the Indian intelligence services are putting together information about the obvious Pakistani participation in that particular incident, including live, real-time control by some of the Pakistani controllers of the attackers as the assault was going on. One of the things that I spoke about in 657 was that in the event of heightened Indian-Pakistani tensions, which is certainly one of the elements of fallout from the Mumbai massacre, it figured that Pakistan might very well begin drawing down troops from the frontier with Afghanistan, where they're being used to contain some of the militants in the tribal area, in order to deploy them along the border with India, and that this would benefit the Taliban and the Muslim Brotherhood combatants in that particular part of the Earth Island. And, of course, the worldwide broadcast sentiment coming out of the Middle East is going to further inflame Islamic sentiment and also, in all probability, aid recruiting efforts for the Taliban and like-minded groups. The following is from Yahoo News. This is an AP story by Nahal Tusi. It's datelined Islamabad, Pakistan. Its headline, Scenic Pakistani Valley Falls to Taliban Militants. It reads in part, Taliban militants are beheading and burning their way through Pakistan's picturesque Swat Valley, and residents say the insurgents now control most of the mountainous region far from the lawless tribal areas where jihadists thrive. The deteriorating situation in the former tourist haven comes despite an army offensive that began in 2007 and an attempted peace deal. It is especially worrisome to Pakistani officials because the valley lies outside the areas where Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants have traditionally operated and where the military is staging a separate offensive. You can't imagine how bad it is, says Muzaffar al-Malik, a federal lawmaker whose home in Swat was attacked by bomb-toting assailants in mid-December, weeks after he left. It's worse day by day, unquote. The Taliban activity in northwest Pakistan also comes as the country shifts forces east to the Indian border because of tensions over last month's terrorist attacks in Mumbai, potentially giving insurgents more space to maneuver along the Afghan frontier. So in addition to a collapsing global and U.S. economy, in addition to all-out bedlam in the Middle East, the other part of the Earth Island, or swinging farther toward the Bay of Bengal and towards the Pacific Ocean, things are heating up there, too, in manner that I pretty much predicted it would. And by the way, I should... It's not to be egotistical. A lot of strategic analysts said that in the event of heightened India-Pakistani tensions, the Pakistanis might draw down troops, thereby aiding the Taliban. And that is exactly what happened. And you can bet that's exactly one of the things that the Mumbai attacks were designed to do. Again, reference For the Record 657. Now, while the foreign policy burner has been heating up, the Middle East and India-Pakistani foreign policy burners getting heated up for Obama, something that has received almost no attention in the United States is the fact that there appears to be the Bush administration and related elements. And again, I believe that the Bush administration is a direct extension of the underground Reich, as is Hamas, as is the Muslim Brotherhood, as is Lashkar-e-Taiba, as is Prince al-Walid, as is Karl Rove, whom I believe is the point element for the underground Reich in this administration. Something is happening, folks, and it's happening in Georgia. Yeah, Georgia. Not Georgia, U.S., Georgia in the middle of the Earth Island, part of what used to be the Soviet Union. And we're going to go marching through Georgia right now. The following is from the Wired blog network. It's called Danger Room. It's called Five for Fighting, a closer look at the Pentagon's Minerva-ish initiative. U.S. and Georgia to sign strategic pact. It's by Nathan Hodge. Had you heard about this, folks? It's dated December 26th of 2008. Merry Christmas, world. More trouble on the Earth Island. It reads, Months after Georgia fought a short, nasty war with its northern neighbor, the United States is moving to shore up security ties with the former Soviet Republic. Agence France-Presse reports that Georgian officials will sign a, quote, strategic partnership, unquote, treaty on January 4th in Washington. On Tuesday, the Department of State issued the first confirmation that the United States and Georgia would pursue a more formal security arrangement. In response to questions from reporters, State issued the following news release. As President Saakashvili noted to the press on December 22nd, the United States and Georgia are discussing the text of a new bilateral charter that will outline our enhanced cooperation to help Georgia advance security, democratic, and market economic reforms to strengthen Georgia, bolster our partnership, and deepen Georgia's Euro-Atlantic integration. This charter is similar to the one signed by the United States and the Ukraine on December 19th in Washington. Note the Ukraine. We're coming back to that in a second as well. This item has largely gone unreported in the U.S. media, but it comes as both Moscow and Tbilisi continue their post-war rhetoric. In a year-end interview with some rather obsequious Russian television reporters, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev took a shot at Saakashvili. "We had the impression that our neighbor was not quite right in the head, but we did not imagine it was to this degree," he said. Saakashvili said Medvedev's comments were an acknowledgement of their Russian aggression, unquote. As discussed in For the Record program number 656, the play in the United States on the Russian-Georgian War of the summer of 2008 was hysterical in a way that much of the accepted information about the conflict in the Middle East is hysterical at this present time. We were told here in the United States that this was just, you know, this was the Russian bear doing what they do and blah, blah, blah. One of the things that received attention from some people was the fact that the number one lobbyist for the Georgian government was also one of the key foreign policy advisors for John McCain. And of course, Sarah Palin, among others, weighed in that we had to prepare to fight Russia over this, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, it was represented here in the United States by the Amen Chorus, Fox News et al. More about Fox News later in the broadcast. That this was, of course, you know, again, the Russians doing what they do, blah, blah. What actually happened was this. Georgia launched a surprise artillery barrage on a sleeping village at night and killed 2,000 people. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a war crime. What the Russians did, again, separating out all of the, you know, well, here they go again, the Russians, you know, the tanks are rolling, blah, blah. What actually the Russians did was they basically destroyed the Georgian military bases from which the attacks were launched. They did a very thorough job of destroying those military bases and then pretty much withdrew. This was not some recrudescence of the evil empire, as Ronald Reagan termed it. But do note that now, while Obama is preparing to come into office, Bush is basically icing U.S.-Soviet relations for Obama. It remains to be seen what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton does in this context. One of Obama's top foreign policy advisors was Zbigniew Brzezinski, who's part of the old Galen contingent, as talked about, by the way, in AFA program number 3. So that's not very encouraging, but note that as Obama is preparing to take office, note how things are being heated up, and note that we are going to sign a security arrangement with Georgia, which is just what we shouldn't be doing. And note also that this is similar to something we did with the Ukraine. And by the way, the Ukraine is in the news. Basically, to make a very long story very short, even after the Cold War ended and after the Soviet Union dissolved, the United States basically pursuing a geopolitical tack that was pure Nazi in its origins and intent, and really pre-Nazi in the sense that it's something of a manifestation of the old great game trying to contain Russia, we have basically continued to pimp-slap Russia around, a weakened Russia, and we have continued to walk NATO literally right up to Russia's borders. And we have been doing so in collaboration with some of the old Nazi elements. And this is not exactly sitting real well in Russia. And again, I'm sorry, this will not sit better with some members of the audience than some of my comments on side one about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But Russia's cause in this particular instance is just, and the cause of the Georgians and the Ukrainians is not. San Francisco Chronicle from today, January 4th of 2009, touches on some of the fallout from this policy of basically continuing to mess with Russia, even after communism fell, after Russia became kind of the ultimate free market state, although albeit a rather corrupt one. By the way, again, the AFA programs, AFA Program 36, the destabilization of the Soviet Union, and AFA 37, the massive, how the United States lost the Second World War. They're available for download for free, folks. The only investment on your part is one of time. Please access them. Today's Chronicle, January 4th of 2009, has an L.A. Times story by Megan K. Stack, headlined, Russia-Ukraine Gas Fight Ripples Westward. It reads in part, fuel delivery to four European countries fell below normal Saturday as Russia's state gas monopoly withheld natural gas from neighboring Ukraine for the third consecutive day. By the way, the rationale was that Ukraine is siphoning off some of the gas that is intended for Western Europe, but it is against the background of this continued bullying of Russia by the United States. And by the way, that is going to have some very interesting fallout vis-a-vis the Middle East, because as we continue to try to mess with Russia, and there are indications that just as we fought a very real war, just as American soldiers and Allied soldiers fought a very real war against the combatants of fascism in World War II, elements of the power elite and the economic elite were also colluding with those very same elements, even while American soldiers are in a very real war against elements of the fascist Muslim Brotherhood in places like Afghanistan. So, too, elements of our power elite and our intelligence system have backed Muslim Brotherhood combatants in Chechnya. The heirs, by the way, to the Waffengruppe der SS Krim, who fought with the SS on the side of the Nazis in that area in World War II. Skipping down. On Saturday, Gazprom accused Ukraine of siphoning off 35 million cubic meters of gas a day bound for Europe. It's not us but Ukraine that uses blackmail toward Russia and Europe, unquote, the vice chairman of Gazprom's board of directors, Alexander Medvedev, told reporters in the Czech Republic, Interfax reported yesterday. Ukraine's pro-Western president has enraged Russia by pushing for NATO membership for the former Soviet state. Well, Ukraine's pro-Western president is Mr. Yushchenko, as noted in a number of different programs, including the description for the record 647 as well as number 529. His wife is the former Ekaterina Chumachenko, who was in charge of presidential liaison under Ronald Reagan, and who also was the point element for the Ukrainian fascist element that was brought into the United States at the end of World War II. We've spoken about that in AFA programs 1, 2, 3, 36, 37, and the aforementioned For the Record shows. Notice now, bearing in mind not only the Earth Island, but the virtual state of the Underground Reich, we're going to take a look at this quote for this pro-Western president. Well, he's that, but he's a whole lot more. He's married to the point element, the former Ekaterina Chumachenko, for the OUNB in the United States. And indeed, Viktor Yushchenko is very close to the OUNB's successors in the Ukraine. From the Transatlantic Intelligencer of December 2nd of 2004, we read, skipping down, Thursday, December 2nd, Europe's Ukraine won. Viktor Yushchenko, Democrat and anti-Semite. A report by the British Helsinki Human Rights Group reports that Viktor Yushchenko, the supposedly pro-Western Democratic candidate for the Ukrainian presidency, defended a large circulation Ukrainian paper that in 2003 published a bizarre anti-Semitic tract claiming, among other things, that some 400,000 Jews participated in the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941. The paper's editor, Vasily Gruzin, is quoted as saying via the Jewish Telegraph Agency, in defense of his decision to publish the tract, quote, I personally have nothing against common Jews, but rather against a small group of Jewish oligarchs who control the Ukraine both economically and politically. I believe the point of Zionism today is Jewish control of the world, and we see this process at work in the Ukraine today, unquote. Sounds rather like Hamas's charter, does it not? Again, the virtual state. Continuing, the paper Silki Visti, which supports the Ukrainian, quote, opposition, unquote, of Viktor Yushchenko, was ordered closed by the Ukrainian court in January of 2004 following charges brought by the Jewish anti-fascist community that it was inciting ethnic hatred. An English-language website on Ukrainian affairs reproduces a press release dated January 29th of 2004 from the website of Viktor Yushchenko's Our Ukraine Party, in which Yushchenko responds to the court decision as follows, quote, "The government will get more and more upset with the truthful information in mass media the closer we get to elections, and it will not be surprising to see increased pressure at other oppositional publications," unquote. That was Yushchenko's response to the closing of that newspaper that came on with that Nazi-style anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. Continuing with this, the BHHRG report titled Shadow of Anti-Semitism Over Ukraine's Disputed Election also points to links between Yushchenko and the Ukrainian nationalist leader Andriy Shkil, who is quoted favorably by citing Nazi ideologist Walter Duray's ideas on eugenics, as well as Mein Kampf. And skipping down. On Yushchenko's support for Shkil, GermanForeignPolicy.com, not an official site of the German Foreign Office, but rather a critical watchdog organ, writes in German, "Precisely in the western Ukrainian city of Lvov, a place where many thousands of Jews were murdered under the Nazi occupation, Yushchenko's electoral alliance supported a leading figure of the extreme-right anti-Semitic party UNA-UNSO, Ukrainian National Assembly, Ukrainian National Self-Defense. The UNA-UNSO counts as militantly anti-Russian and advocates a Ukrainian-German-Spanish axis," unquote. "It belongs to the tradition of Ukrainian Nazi collaborators. The Ukrainian Nazi collaborators were members of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, OUNB. The anti-Semitic nationalist bloc, quote, enjoyed the particular protection of the German Abwehr, German military intelligence in World War II. The Congress of Ukrainian Nationalists, or KUN, is considered the contemporary successor organization of the OUNB. It forms part of the electoral alliance of Viktor Yushchenko." So we are basically supporting the same Ukrainian fascists we brought in at the end of World War II. They crop up in the context of the investigation of Kennedy's assassination. So again, the Earth Island, the virtual state, that Ukrainian fascist publication, sounds rather like what we were reading in the Hamas charter. Again, folks, you got to think outside of the box here to keep up with the virtual state and the underground Reich. And they are heating it up for Obama. Another suspicious death. Now, bearing in mind what we were talking about in connection with Georgia, one of John McCain's top foreign policy advisors. And again, note that the Mumbai assault was originally scheduled to take place during the U.S. campaign. But of course, part of the Bush-McCain shtick, so to speak, was to maintain that they are strong on national security and were helping to keep down the war on terror, blah, 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 blah. Actually, they did about as much as they possibly could have to precipitate the war on terror. The invasion of Iraq was about the worst thing they could have done. And of course, not McCain, but the Bush administration bears a significant element of culpability, not only in September 11th, but also in the funding of Islamic terrorism when the Operation Green Quest raids took place on March 20th of 2002. They not only popped the top Al-Qaeda funding apparatus, but the top funding apparatus for Hamas and for Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And who should intercede on behalf of them but Talat Altman, director of Harkin Energy, close associate of both Georges Bush, a guy who gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention in 2000, and someone who's very close to people who are in a position to make things very uncomfortable for Barack Obama in the Blagojevich investigation. But now bear in mind that one of McCain's top foreign policy advisors during the campaign was the former top lobbyist for the Georgian government. Listen to the following. We talked about a suspicious death inside one. This is really suspicious. Yahoo News carries the following story. It's from December 20th of 2008. It's headlined, "Bush insider who planned to tell all killed in plane crash. Nonprofit demands full federal investigation." It reads in part, Michael Connell, the Bush IT expert who has been directly implicated in the rigging of George Bush's 2000 and 2004 elections, was killed last night when his single-engine plane crashed 3 miles short of the Akron airport. Velvet Revolution is a nonprofit that has been investigating Mr. Connell's activities for the past 2 years and can now reveal that a person close to Mr. Connell has recently been discussing with a VR investigator how he can tell all about his work for George Bush. Well, he's not going to tell anything right now, is he? Or ever again. Not alive, anyway. Mr. Connell told a close associate that he was afraid that George Bush and Dick Cheney would, quote, throw him under the bus, unquote. A tipster close to the McCain campaign, repeating again, a tipster close to the McCain campaign disclosed to Velvet Revolution in July that Mr. Connell's life was in jeopardy and that Karl Rove had threatened him and his wife, Heather. VR's attorney Cliff Arnebeck notified the United States Attorney General, Ohio law enforcement, and the federal court about these threats and insisted that Mr. Connell be placed in protective custody. VR also told a close associate of Mr. Connell's not to fly his plane because of another tip that the plane could be sabotaged. Mr. Connell, a very experienced pilot, has had to abandon at least 2 flights in the past 2 months because of suspicious problems with his plane. On December 18, 2008, Mr. Connell flew to a small airport outside of Washington, D.C. to meet some people. It was on his return flight the next day that he crashed. On October 31st, Mr. Connell appeared before a federal judge in Ohio after being subpoenaed in a federal lawsuit investigating the rigging of the 2004 election under the direction of Karl Rove. The judge ordered Mr. Connell to testify under oath at a deposition on November 3rd, the day before the presidential election. Velvet Revolution received confidential information that the White House was extremely concerned about Mr. Connell talking about his illegal work for the White House, and 2 Bush-Cheney-04 attorneys were dispatched to represent him. An associate of Mr. Connell's told Velvet Revolution that Mr. Connell was involved with the destruction of the White House emails and the setting up of the off-grid White House email system. Mr. Connell handled all of John McCain's computer work in the recent presidential campaign. Note that. Mr. Connell handled all of John McCain's computer work in the recent presidential campaign. VR has received direct evidence that the McCain campaign kept abreast of the legal developments against Mr. Connell by reading the VR dedicated website. Wonder what Mr. Connell knew about the shenanigans in Georgia, Well, they are heating it up for Obama. In For the Record, at 6:54 and 6:55 and 6:56, I talked about badjacketing Obama. And in those programs, I accessed a series of Scoop News articles by Evelyn Pringle. For example, the March 29, 2008 article, Barack Obama, the Wizard of Oz, talks at length about the links between the badjacketing milieu, including Karl Rove, and Governor Blagojevich, who, by the way, I mispronounced that Blagojevich. It's Blagojevich. Now everybody, including yours truly, knows how to pronounce that name because they're heating it up for Obama on the domestic front. And who do you suppose appeared on Fox News to turn up the heat a little bit higher? From the Fox News website, Sunday, December 28th of 2008, Jamie Colby, a Fox News guest host, was hosting... This is headlined, Karl Rove takes on the Bush legacy and the challenges facing President-elect Obama. This will be on the description for the program, but Karl Rove is talking about, well, yeah, it looks like Governor Blagojevich is going to really make things uncomfortable for Barack Obama. That's one of the things I talked about, 654, 655, 656, bad jacketing Obama. They're right on schedule. And bear in mind that the second largest stockholder in News Corp, the parent company of Fox News, behind Gruppenführer Murdoch himself, is Prince al-Walid of Hamas. He does Muslim Brotherhood does fundraisers for Hamas. And of course, things are heating up on the domestic economic front for Obama as well. We've got this bailout, folks, haven't we? It looks like the recession could turn into a depression. San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, November 26th of 2008 has a column by Kathleen Pender talking about just how big the bailout is. This is called Bailout Grows. Total relief package up to $8.5 trillion. Nobody knows risk to taxpayers. Skipping down, That sum, $8.5 trillion, according to Bloomberg News, represents almost 60% of the nation's estimated gross domestic product. How do you like them apples, folks? And not only that, but how do you like these apples, too? I alluded to this in, for the record, 658. In a David Sirota column, there was a reference to this. This is a report commissioned by the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Not exactly a fringe conspiracy outfit, is it? It is ironically titled Working Paper 666. Listen to the following about the economic quote, crisis, unquote. Three myths about quantities. The financial crisis has been associated with three widely held claims about the nature of the crisis and the associated spillovers to the rest of the economy. The financial press and policymakers have made the following three claims about the nature of the crisis. One, bank lending to non-financial corporations and individuals has declined sharply. Interbank lending is essentially non-existent. And three, commercial paper issuance by non-financial corporations has declined sharply and rates have risen to unprecedented levels. Here we examine these claims using data from the Federal Reserve and Bloomberg. Our argument that all three claims are false is based on data up until October 15th of 2008. And then there's analysis of these. This is a very technical paper, as you might imagine, coming from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, has figures. And basically, it says, skipping down, these figures show that the first claim, that banks have essentially stopped lending to non-bank entities and individuals, is false, at least in the aggregate, as of October 15th. More analysis of figures, and it basically indicates these figures show that while commercial paper issued by financial institutions has declined, commercial paper issued by non-financial institutions is essentially unchanged during the financial crisis. And skipping down again, we have documented that commercial and industrial loans made by banks have risen dramatically during the period of the financial crisis. And it goes on to it. This will, by the way, this excerpt will be in the description for the this broadcast. Data that support, skipping down again, data that support this story, especially data that support the signaling view, would be extremely useful. Federal Reserve says, we have seen no data from the current crisis that support this story, especially the signaling view component. So why are we having an $8.5 trillion bailout, roughly 60% of gross domestic product? Yes, indeedy, folks. They're heating it up for Obama, returning again ever so briefly to the Middle East. Bear in mind that Fox News, second largest stockholder in News Corp, is Prince Al-Waleed. Also, by the way, largest stockholder in Citicorp and a person who lobbied along with other Arabs deeply involved in American banking at this point for deep-sixing the Glass-Steagall Act, which protected against some of the excesses that produced the financial crisis. What in bloody hell is going on, folks? Oh, well, one thing that is going on, watch the war drums in the Middle East, as I've said so often, hasn't gone up that much, but Yahoo News has noted the following. Reuters story in New York, oil rises $2 on Israel and weak dollar. So the weak economy and the heating it up in the Middle East has caused a slight rise in the price of oil. We will see. Nobody has any money. What remains to be seen just what the rising temperatures in the Middle East do to the price of oil. But whenever there's war in the Middle East, up goes the price of oil. And as one Arab banker quoted in one Arab businessman, I should say, quoted in For the Records 560 and 561 said, it's always good for us, unquote. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 569, Heating It Up for Obama. This has been recorded on January 4th of the year 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.
Join WFMU and Dave Emery next Tuesday at 6 p.m. for a past program chock full of practical prophecy. For the Record, number 248, Bush, the Political Heritage of George W. Bush. As we bid adieu to an oily White House dynasty, we look at the Nazi heritage of W., back through the hazy exhaust emissions of 8 years, the rule of torture, the gutting of habeas corpus and the Bill of Rights, the rise in oil prices, massive increase in defense spending, enormous deficits, .. Fun for the whole family. That's Dave Emery's For the Record every Tuesday at 6 p.m. right here on WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org. Stay tuned for the Antique Phonograph Music Program with Mac. As we wait for Mac.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, hello, and welcome to another edition of the Antique Phonograph Music Program. We are on the air, and here bringing you another hour of music coming from the phonograph. We're running around here, getting started, and we started off with a cameo disc from 1925. It was the group of the singers Adler, Wheel, and Herman, along with the California Sun-Kissed Syncopators, on a song called Who is the One That You're Fooling Now? From 1925. And now let's go on to the Southampton Society Orchestra with a record on the Perfect label from 1924. This is called Beautiful Heaven.
Thank you. cover, and on my wedding day, when the fun was over and the guests had gone away, my old darling said to me, "You must be hungry, Joe. Is there anything you fancy?" I said, "Fancy, don't you know? I like pickled onions. I like pickled lily. Pickled cabbage is all right with a bit of cold meat on Sunday night. I can go to Martyrs', but what I do prefer is a little bit of cucumber, little bit of cucumber." I went flying through the air with my old colleague Sam. Suddenly he said to me, "We're bound for kingdom come. Have you anything on your brain before you wear a crown?" I began to shake and said, "Write this confession down. I like big..."